From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, critical race theory, why it's become a hotly debated topic between parents, teachers, and school boards.
I think there's a lot of mythology and rumor and confusion, so that people are kind of arguing about things that they are not actually clear on what's happening.
The family of Naya Rivera speaks out a year after her drowning.
He said, "Don't worry, we have Josie, but your daughter's missing." I was just pushed backwards, just screaming.
And we'll take you to America's newest national park and the debate over its new designation.
All of us business owners, now we're getting our moment and we believe we're ready for it, but it's been complicated by, is the park ready for it?
All ahead on Perspective. We're going to begin this week in Tokyo, where the final decision was made on Thursday. Venues will be empty for the Summer Olympics. The Games, already delayed by a year because of the pandemic, will take place under a coronavirus state of emergency issued by Japan's prime minister. At first, they were going to allow only Japanese fans in to watch. Now, even that is not allowed. ABC's Jim Ryan has covered several Olympic Games for us here at ABC News, including another amidst a health crisis caused by a virus. He'll be heading to Tokyo soon. I got to talk to him this week about what he expects will happen without those cheering crowds. How big a deal will it be with no fans in the stand? You've covered Olympics before. Do they make that big of a difference?
Well, they really do. I think they have an impact the same way that teams here, college teams and professional teams, they love having fans out there. And fans feel that they do have some influence on the outcome of games or matches. So I think there will be some impact from that. The athletes are going to miss that a bit, Sherry.
Yeah, we actually heard from Tampa Bay this week talking about how much the difference the fans made in the stands when they won the Stanley Cup finals.
We were missing this, and that was a big thing for us, was like we didn't get to share it with not only our fans, but Florida and Carolina and Islanders and every team in the league. Like, as watching the fans be able to come back in the building and even in Montreal, like, that's why we play.
You know, for a lot of the players, it makes a difference.
It's what builds this national camaraderie as well. I think the fans from different countries, and I've talked with a lot of fans from various nations at events in Sochi and then at Rio 4 or 5 years ago, about the experience of being there and the joie de vivre that you feel, not only with your countrymen who are in the stands, but also with the other countries' fans. And flags are waving, and you feel this sense of patriotism, but this sense of belonging to a larger community when you're there inside that arena.
But the reason that they're doing it is a really serious one. That their cases in Japan, they are going up, and the Delta variant is a real big concern. And people in Japan don't really want the Olympics. And the Olympics that you've covered in the past, how have people from that country felt about the Olympics? Obviously, not a pandemic, but how have they felt?
I'll go back to Sochi, and the Russians were quite welcoming. They were okay with having the event there. Naturally, every country and its people complain about the cost that goes into it, and there are promises always that the venues will be reused for something else. The Russians said, this will be a great sports training facility after the Olympics were gone. Well, if you look at any pictures on the internet about what's happened to Sochi since then, it's kind of crumbled into the ground. It's sad to see what it's like. In Rio, people were welcoming of that event as well. Then, of course, the threat. Remember this? Zika. Remember Zika?
I do.
That was the big concern back then.
Zika is a relatively inconsequential virus for the general population, but if you're a pregnant woman who gets exposed, it's a big deal.
Zika, carried by mosquitoes, was something that was still going through Brazil. And in fact, the media kit, when you landed on the ground there, you were handed a little backpack, and it contained stuff like pencils and pens and pins and things. But also, and I still have this, the jar of off, you know, the bug repellent off. Sure. With the instructions in Portuguese. It's a real collector's item, and it was there specifically and strictly because of the threat posed by Zika. They wanted you to use that to repel mosquitoes. It became kind of quite literally a battle cry to some Brazilians. Listen to this crowd of fans at a women's beach volleyball match. They were chanting Zika to try to rattle the American fans who were there to watch beach volleyball. You know, their thinking at the time was that Americans were making way too much of it.
This is a state of emergency in Tokyo. How do you feel about going to the games, about going through airports? How are you feeling about it?
I'm okay with it. I feel pretty confident. You know, the Japanese are acting in an abundance of caution, obviously. I mean, the strictness of the requirements to go cover the Olympics this time. I'm fully vaccinated, have to be in order to go there. Within 96 hours of leaving for Japan, I have to have 2 negative COVID tests, and I have to have those documented and signed by the doctor who did the test, and it has to be an approved clinic or testing site approved by the Japanese government. Once I'm in Japan, I have to quarantine in my hotel room for 3 days before anything can happen. For the first 15 days, all of us covering the events will have to undergo daily COVID testing. So you can tell it. I mean, they're being extremely cautious about COVID-19, probably for good reason with such a low vaccination rate there.
Very, very different Olympics with Japan and Tokyo in a state of emergency now. Thanks, Jim.
All right. See you soon.
Elsa went from a tropical storm to a hurricane, back down to a tropical storm this week as it approached Florida and then made its way up the eastern seaboard. That's what it sounded like when Elsa pounded Tybee Island, Georgia, not far from Savannah. The storm mostly spared the state of Florida, but it did make the work of those trying to clear rubble and debris from the Surfside condo collapse even harder, with likely no chance of finding any survivors. Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava made the announcement, saying,
"We made the extremely difficult decision to transition from Operation Search and Rescue to Recovery."
ABC's Victor Okendo has been covering the collapse since it happened more than 2 weeks ago. He was there when searchers held a moment of silence before their mission shifted.
Rescuers and officials notifying the families of the missing before making the official announcement. The mayor overcome with emotion when translating her remarks in Spanish.
Estaremos de regreso aquí a las 5:30. Gracias.
It's been around-the-clock searching in grueling conditions, fighting fires, storms, and intense heat. But now authorities determining there is no chance of life in the rubble. With the remaining portion of the tower demolished, crews have been able to reach previously inaccessible areas. On Wednesday alone, 18 victims were found. Rescue personnel and officials gathering for a moment of silence at the collapse site.
It was dramatic news that came in early Wednesday morning. Haitian President Jovenel Moïse killed in an attack at his home before dawn, and the country's prime minister declaring himself in control of the troubled Caribbean country hours later. ABC's Rachel Scott explains what happened.
Haiti's first lady rushed to Miami by private plane hours after she and her husband, Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse, were ambushed in their own home. Shortly after 1 a.m., a group of heavily armed men breaking in, shooting and killing the 53-year-old head of state. A neighbor says there was such a barrage of gunfire, it felt like an earthquake. Haiti's ambassador to the U.S. described the assassins as armed commandos who spoke Spanish and English and posed as American DEA agents. Authorities declaring a state of siege, closing the international airport, the busy capital streets emptied out. Haiti has long been gripped by political turmoil and unrest. It has the poorest economy in the West. Not a single dose of the COVID vaccine yet distributed. Moïse had been ruling by decree for over a year and was facing calls to step down.
Sécurité pays a sous contrôle.
The acting prime minister calling for calm to, quote, make sure the country does not fall into chaos. President Biden condemning the assassination.
It's very worrisome about the state of Haiti.
The acting prime minister says that he is now in charge of the government, but the U.S. government is calling for free and fair elections by the end of the year.
That's ABC's Rachel Scott. There was another fight over tenure at a major university this week that ended in a rejected offer by a black faculty member. ABC's Derek Dennis has that story.
Journalist and professor Nicole Hannah-Jones turning down a tenured faculty position at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, after the school initially refused to give her tenure, then offered her the promotion only at the last minute due to national outrage and student faculty outcry. Jones is African American and says she was discriminated against, her tenure position held up, while white faculty family members before her were easily elevated. So what's next? Jones has accepted an offer to become a distinguished chair of journalism at Howard University in Washington, D.C. School officials at Chapel Hill say they're disappointed in Jones's decision.
There's also been a growing backlash in some education circles around the country regarding an anti-racism curriculum known as critical race theory. ABC's Terry Moran takes an in-depth look at what it is and why it has caused so many parents, teachers, and politicians to speak out.
Schools in America are supposed to be places where dreams are born and our children learn to reach for them together. But today, more and more of our schools, like so many other places in American life, have become battlegrounds where the adults are fighting each other furiously over issues of identity, power, and the meaning of our history.
Our children are taught in school to hate their own country.
As President Donald Trump, with characteristic bluster and exaggeration, stoked the controversy in the schools, he made local schools a national issue.
We will stop the radical indoctrination of our students and children and restore patriotic education to our schools.
I think there's a lot of mythology and rumor and confusion, so that people are kind of arguing about things that they are not actually clear on what's happening.
Takiema Bunch-Smith is a former New York City school teacher and now executive director of the Center on Culture, Race, and Equity at Bank Street College of Education. She helps schools and other organizations implement equity policies and practices.
This is really a time, I think, to think about ultimately, what kind of world do I want to live in, and what kind of a world do my children deserve to live in?
How we get there is bitterly dividing school communities, bringing a long simmering conflict to full boil.
There is definitely an overfixation with race. In New York City, 50% of our kids aren't even reading at grade proficient level.
Yatin Chu is the mom of a 10-year-old who attends a New York City public school, an immigrant to America from Taiwan, and co-president of Place NYC. That's an advocacy group.
It is infusing a lot of what students are learning in the classroom with discussions about race. I find that to be problematic.
Then there's the fight over what and how kids are taught about social justice and equality and the conceptual tool some schools are using to do that. It's called critical race theory.
Critical race theory is not a bad word, although it may have been demonized. It's about equity. It's about justice.
President Trump actually banned critical race theory from being used by the federal government in racial sensitivity trainings for federal employees.
This is a Marxist doctrine, holding that America is a wicked and racist nation.
There's no strict definition of critical race theory, but basically it's a reformist theory that supports a redistribution of power in institutions by exposing racism and acting to eliminate it.
It's about making sure that every single child gets to thrive and be fully human.
Advocates point to data they say reveal the scope of the racial disparities in our schools. A 2019 report found that 44% of white eighth graders were deemed proficient at math, compared with just 14% of black students and 20% of Hispanic students. And a 2016 report on disciplining practices in schools found that black K through 12 students are 3.8 times more likely to receive out-of-school suspensions than white students.
Do you attribute what happened in your kids' lives to racism, either implicit, unconscious, embedded, or otherwise?
Absolutely. It is a matter of unconscious bias.
Pastor Michelle Thomas is a mom of three in Loudoun County, Virginia, and the head of the local NAACP. Her kids all went to public schools. Michelle says she had to fight to get her daughter Anna into an advanced science program, even though she had the requisite grades and scores.
You got a great kid that could have been and was in honors classes, but her mommy had to push.
Opponents of this kind of training, they say you're by focusing on race, it's divisive. It's making people more conscious of it and therefore more racist.
If you had cancer and did not focus on it, you will die. Racism is a cancer that's killing America.
Some parents are speaking out at the Riverdale Country School in the Bronx.
Children are being taught to see each other as defined by their skin color.
Brian Bartning is an investor in New York and co-founder of the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism, which advocates against CRT-based education. Bardning, who describes himself as half Mexican, Native American, and half Jewish, took his two young children out of Riverdale when he learned about the equity curriculum.
They didn't really stop and say, well, is this really achieving our goals?
Bardning says his foundation already has 20,000 members from across the country, parents concerned about the impact of these new ideas on their kids.
When we have a whole bunch of little kids who are told from a very young age that they are defined by their skin color, you're going to end up with a society where everybody's tribal and everybody is racist.
Our students are not living in a colorblind society.
Scott Ziegler is interim superintendent of the Loudoun County, Virginia School Board outside Washington, D.C. And here, too, race and justice in the schools have divided families, with social media threats actually triggering a criminal investigation. His view of this swirling controversy is simple.
If I start making decisions based on what adults want, what adults need, I've missed the mark.
You've got a group of parents who have gotten very angry about these efforts. They're accusing you of trying to impose an ideology on their children.
That's not what we're about. I'm here to do the best that I can for students. My students are telling me that they're having racially charged incidents in our schools. And that tells me I need to do something about that.
I'm Terry Moran in Loudoun County, Virginia.
The family of Naya Rivera is honoring her memory and who she was as a daughter, a sister, mother, and an artist on the one-year anniversary of her tragic death. The Glee star went missing on July 8th in California, where she had spent the day with her then four-year-old son, Josie. Her mother, Yolanda, and sister, Nikayla, spoke with ABC's Juju Chang.
Naya Rivera was a triple threat talent on Glee. She could act, she could sing.
Girls, you know you better. Watch out.
And boy, could she dance. But on July 8th, 2020, everything would change.
It was a beautiful morning. I missed two of her FaceTime calls, and I called her back. I said, Naya, where are you? She's like, oh, me and Josie were gonna go to the lake and I was gonna have them fish.
And do you remember what you said in those final FaceTime moments?
I told her, I go, well, the water's getting choppy. And I said, I love you. Call me when you get off the water.
Yolanda talked to her daughter from that rented pontoon boat as the devoted single mom set out for adventure on Lake Piru with her son. But hours later, the then four-year-old Josie was found by another boater, asleep, adrift, alone wearing a life vest. Naya was gone.
He said, don't worry, we have Josie, but your daughter's missing. And it was almost like a force. I was just pushed backwards, just screaming.
For five grueling days, rescue teams searched day and night. The Glee family holding vigil lakeside.
We saw people holding vigil, people holding hands. What were those days like for you guys?
Those first 5 days were
hell.
Awful.
Hell on earth.
Thank God I took the pictures because they were able to look at the topography of the land to locate where they were.
Do you take screenshots?
I took screenshots of the FaceTime call.
Naya was found 6 days later. Investigators believe she managed to save her son, but then drowned accidentally. Her younger sister, Nikayla, moving in with the boy's father, the fashion model now helping to raise little Josie.
Right when we got him, I knew the role that I had to take.
Now I see Josie, and he's like a boy version of her in every sense of the word.
In what way?
Just his tenacity, his drive, his zeal, his adventure for life. He's Naya in boy form.
Yes. He loves entertaining.
Yes.
He loves singing at the top of his lungs.
From a young age, Naya was a force to be reckoned with. But her breakout role, Glee's Santana Lopez, an openly queer Latina.
Because all I want to be able to do is kiss my girlfriend, but I guess no one can see that because there's such an insane double standard at this school.
I honestly don't think that she even knew the impact that she had. People would come up to her all the time and say, you saved my life. My sister, even though she was acting, was touching people's real lives, helping them become who they really are.
Yolanda hopes that Naya's life leaves one lasting message.
I would like my daughter's, Naya's, legacy to be one that teaches people to love. Love who you are, because you don't get another life.
Coming up, West Virginia's new River Gorge. why designating the area's newest national park has caused a little pushback. On Perspective after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon slash spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, we speak to a former inmate who has started her own thriving coffee business. But first, the New River Gorge in West Virginia was named the country's 63rd national park as a part of the December COVID-19 relief bill. And although always well known regionally, it has quickly turned into a popular outdoor destination. Its 70,000 acres worth of scaling rock and lush green trees is a haven for mountain bikers, hikers, rock climbers, and whitewater rafters. ABC's Eric Mallow took a trip to the New River Gorge over Memorial Day weekend with his fiance, Michelle. He's got more on what the park offers and why some are pushing back against it.
Sherry, it took 11 hours of driving through the rain to reach the city of Beckley, West Virginia, where we stayed. It's located about half an hour south of the Canyon Rim Visitor Center, the first stop on our journey through the New River Gorge, or as locals were calling it, the New. COVID restrictions limited capacity in the center, but there was still a long line to get in. Even on a wet, overcast weekend, we got the sense the word was out and first-time visitors like us were going to be scattered throughout the park.
So we're leaving the Canyon Rim Visitor Center. On our way to the car to the Endless Rim Trail? I don't even remember what it's called.
Endless Wall.
Endless Wall, thank you.
We drove just around the corner to begin hiking the Endless Wall Trail, a moderate incline leading hikers up high above the flowing New River.
This is tight. I feel like a mountain goat walking right along the edge.
Oh my God.
This is so cool.
There was a lot of that kind of reaction on this trip, and we weren't the only ones impressed.
It's actually a lot bigger than we first thought.
We met Jen and Max, hikers from the Pittsburgh area.
It doesn't feel like you're 3 hours outside of Pittsburgh.
Wow, okay, that's all that is from there, 3 hours. Yeah.
They had New River Gorge circled on their bucket list, but said the national park designation did prompt their visit.
I think it put more of an urgency just for, like, wanting to cross off my list, but it's been on his list for years.
Yeah.
So we were definitely going to come here no matter what.
Like we said in the visitor center, it's almost shaped like a canyon. Called the Grand Canyon of the East.
Endless Wall didn't just offer some great views of the river and trees.
So you literally, up at Diamond's Point, after our conversation with our new friends from Pittsburgh, can see the New River Gorge Bridge, which is the bridge in West Virginia, which we drove over unexpectedly. Did not realize what we were doing.
The 3,000-foot steel behemoth is one of the largest single-span arch bridges in the entire world. It's almost 1,000 feet high and a state landmark, and it's kind of everywhere. You see it on postcards. You can even see it depicted on one side of their state quarter. And we wanted to go see the bridge up close. Then we would descend down to the New River. But on our way, we met a couple first-time hikers of the New, just like us.
A couple of chapters of Quick, which is a queer-focused climbing group.
Brenda and Helena were part of the group. Helena had been to a few national parks herself.
Been to the Grand Canyon, Acadia National Park, Yosemite.
According to their leader, Brian, though, the New River Gorge might be getting more attention now that it's a national park. But for those who live in the surrounding area, the secret's kind of been out.
Climbing hasn't changed. Hiking hasn't changed, to my knowledge.
All right, at the end of the trailhead, saw the river from a very high point. Wouldn't want to fall. Wouldn't want to climb.
The winding drive to the bridge was slow and steady.
We're on the one-way road, Fayette Station Road. We're going to the bridge.
But it didn't take too long.
There's the bridge. We're right under it. Oh my God.
Here, wow, that's some shot.
Wow, that is so cool.
Wow, wow,
now
wow.
You can walk under that.
And you can. Daredevils are harnessed and can walk across one of the steel beams along the middle of the bridge, but we were going to save that for our next visit. By the way, the wildlife, as you can imagine, is diverse and populated. White-tailed deer, black bears, you might even spot a bald eagle if you're lucky, but what we were really hoping to see was a beaver. They are around, and we almost did see one right by the bridge.
There's a beaver.
Oh my God.
But that's when we really started to show we were from New York.
What is it? Oh, where you live?
New York.
After our faux beaver spotting, we continued our descent from the bridge.
Crossing, I don't even know what bridge this is. We'll talk about it after.
Well, this is an area rich in history, and that happened to be the 132-year-old Fayette Station Bridge that crosses the New River, which we finally reached.
I want to feel how cold the water is.
Me too.
Yeah.
Fucking think I'll do it.
Oh, it's nice.
And of course, as one can expect in West Virginia, spotted a train traveling along the tracks that cut right next to the river, and of course, carrying coal.
The thing that I love about this is like exactly what I picture when I think West Virginia.
Everything I'm telling you happened over the course of 3 to 4 hours. There's so much more to do and see here, from old coal mines to countless natural wonders to adventurous activities. It's hard to fit it all in 48 hours. The next day, we worked our way up the distance of the park to hike several trails. We began in the southeastern corner at the Sandstone Falls Boardwalk and were introduced to the New River's largest waterfall that spanned 1,500 feet. We then drove west to tiptoe alongside the fortress rock wall and exposed coal seams on the Castle Rock Trail.
This is really, really cool. This is so different.
And got our postcard shot of the New River Gorge Bridge on the Long Point Trail.
There's a bridge right there. Wow, you got a great shot of it right in front of you. Wow, wait. We did not get this close yesterday.
Officials say people are visiting the gorge. This is Park Superintendent Lizzie Watts.
We have seen an uptick again this year since the designation.
She suggests planning ahead before you come.
Know what the popular trails are, and then also have an alternative. Try to do it Monday through Friday if you can. Part of your experience is you want that grandeur of enjoying it to yourself or with your party.
In between all of our hiking, we wanted to explore the town of Fayetteville and the surrounding areas of the park. Less than half a mile away from Long Point Trail, we stopped by the Arrowhead Bike Farm and Campground, where visitors can rent mountain bikes and grab a bike.
We kind of focus and cater to mountain bikers, though we host and love all other activity doers.
Adam Stevens owns the Arrowhead Bike Farm. He's a veteran of the outdoor and mountain biking industry. He's excited about the national park designation, but isn't so sure of its immediate impact.
Because COVID also gave a huge bump in our local visitation.
At the equipment shop Waterstone Outdoors, they too noticed a spike.
The foot traffic is off the hook.
Maura Kistler is the co-owner of Waterstone.
All of us business owners, now we're getting our moment and we believe we're ready for it, but it's been complicated by, is the park ready for it?
Maddie is one of their team climbing employees. She's excited, but expressed some similar worries about the influx of visitors.
Parking lots were already like totally full and, you know, trails were being like congested.
The infrastructure caused some concern, but Maura thinks the park will adjust.
We just need a few more parking lots, and we need to get better at distributing our visitors across our park.
There are hopes in expanding parking to accommodate a flow of visitors. Then there's another issue steeped in tradition in West Virginia, hunting.
We're not against tourism, not against national parks. I just never personally saw the reason why they had to take this area away from hunters.
Larry Case writes for the blog Guns and Cornbread. He spent decades as a conservation officer and hunter in the New River Gorge.
Hunters need to be concerned about public land access. When you have a, quote, national park, there is no hunting there.
Now, they didn't stop hunting in the gorge. Making the distinction of the name of this park is important. About 10% of the gorge is a national park. The rest of it is a preserve. That's where you can hunt. Advocates for naming this a national park say hunters lost just a small portion of territory, but those who oppose the designation argue since the New River was established as a national river in 1978, there's a bit of a misconception about what protection means.
We didn't need to change it to a, quote, national park. No more protected than it was 40 years ago.
This, they argue, was more of a sacrifice.
A lot of us hunters, we feel this area was taken from us.
There's another thing I observed about the New River Gorge, and it's not just about its natural beauty. Something I didn't know I'd really find there. There's a mutual respect between these competing forces. Back to Maura for a second.
I know Larry Case. He's a good man. These are hunting grounds that had been used for generations, and that is never an easy thing to accept.
There's a genuine understanding between people that when it comes to issues it feels like everyone would agree on, who wouldn't really want a national park in their state? Well, it's actually complicated, and there are in fact winners and losers. What people will find at the New River Gorge National Park and Preserve is it's not just a scenic beauty and outdoor playground. That it definitely is. It also tells an American story, where diverse viewpoints do coexist, sometimes begrudgingly. But there's hope that this park and hosting a number of new visitors can work together to preserve the interest of one another and make the region more prosperous and just as green as they know it to be. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Eric Mallo, ABC News.
As workers return to the office, the majority say working from home has improved their finances, according to a new study from Bankrate anyway. So what will the return to the office mean for workers, for their wallets, and what's it all going to look like? Here's ABC's Daria Albinger.
Admit it, you've gotten pretty comfortable working from home, especially financially.
Working from home has been really kind to Americans' finances. We found that 57% of people who've worked from home during the pandemic said that it helped their personal finances. Only 10% said it hurt. And I think that this really stands out in a few key categories. Commuting, obviously, food, clothes, childcare. There are intangible benefits, too, like more freedom, more family time, and more sleep.
Bankrate's Ted Rossman can relate. Since the start of the pandemic, he's been doing his job from his home in suburban New York, dressed all business from the waist up. And, well, let's say Ted, like a lot of us, has a new affinity for sweatpants. And now that's about to change for many people. After we got used to being home, the boss is calling us back to the office.
Some of it, I think, is that the vaccines seem to be working really well. I know there's still some uncertainty there with variants and not everybody has been vaccinated or not everybody wants to be. But I do think that the rapid progress we've seen helps.
If people could have their way, what would most people like to do? Do they want to go back to the office, do a hybrid thing?
There are a lot of mixed opinions on this. I think it nets out to some kind of hybrid approach, but it's hard to define it really neatly. The way it'll probably net out is most of the time in the office, but maybe a day or two per week at home.
Depending on what you do, though, you may not get a choice. So, Ted, how do we adjust?
I've been hearing a lot of these soft openings where it's voluntary and they say the office is open. Some companies are targeting more of a full return by September. I think that will ease some of the transition period. I also think that giving choice is a way to appeal to both sides. I think even in the past few months, we've seen a trend towards office reopenings. A few months ago, I might have said, no, I think more people will be home permanently. In fact, most COVID work from homers are already back in the office at least some of the time. So I think long term, most people will be in the office at least some of the time.
And that means rethinking what it means to come back to work, even for those of us who have been going in throughout the pandemic. I got to learn to put makeup on again. I got to learn to wear real shoes again. I mean, it's like sneakers all the time in the office for me now. Are we going to keep some of those habits that we broke during the pandemic as we come back to work?
I'd like to keep some of them around. For instance, total credit card debt is 17% lower now than it was before the pandemic. Whether that was stimulus or people spending less, probably all the above. But I think that would be great to stick around. My gut feeling, though, is most things will go back to the way they were.
And since we're getting real, what are you going to have to do, Ted? What habits have you gotten into? What are you going to have to break when you come back to the office?
The commute's the big one for me. I do enjoy that I've been able to see my wife and kids more during the pandemic. I mean, we had a daughter born in January, so it's actually been really nice to be around for more of the first few months, and that you can see your family when you work from home. So I will miss that.
So go to your closet, reach way in the back, and dust off those suits, bust them out. And if you don't physically bust out of them after all those months in sweatpants, wear them to your basement workstation or wherever you're going to work these days, and get ready to go back to the daily grind. Reporting for Perspective, Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Finally this week, would you hire someone for your company who had a criminal record? Somebody who had served time behind bars? We'd guess most business owners would probably answer no to that question. So what if you were the one who served time and started your own business? That's the idea behind the company that entrepreneur Brian Hamilton founded. He came up with the idea almost 30 years ago while taking part in a prison ministry program with Reverend Robert Harris, a friend from North Carolina.
During one of his sessions, one of the breaks, one of the people came up, one of the guys, and I sort of making small talk. I said, hey, what are you going to do when you get out of prison? And the guy said, well, I'm going to get a job. I mean, Sherry, I'll be honest, when he said it, I was thinking, wow, that might be hard to do, you know, because with your record and all that. And of course, today with the internet, it's even harder, in my opinion. So my thought was, as an entrepreneur, instead of getting a job, go create your own job, start your own small business. And that's the genesis of Inmates to Entrepreneurs.
Claudia Shivers was released from prison in July of 2020 after serving almost a year for conspiracy to commit tax fraud.
My plan actually was to just sit at home in my bedroom and cry for about 6 months and then maybe go out and ask someone if they would give me a job, because I thought my reputation was shattered and I didn't see myself being able to be an entrepreneur because I thought that nobody would trust me. So going through the program helped me to get over the barrier of that lack of self-confidence.
She is now the owner of Queen Coffee Bean in High Point, North Carolina.
I learned how to dream big, but start small. So just take just a few hundred dollars, buy a small roaster, started roasting in the kitchen, eventually moved out of the kitchen into my own location. So, and Queen Coffee Bean actually is named after my grandmother, whose name was Queen Esther.
Well, give me some tips, Brian, of what you tell these folks when they get out. What is some of the training that they learn?
Well, we go from soup to nuts. We really do. It's the whole thing. We start out with basic things like getting an EIN number, how to get your first customer, how to do marketing. In Claudia's case, how can we get the coffee into a small store quickly? You know, how to meet somebody and present yourself. Of course, Claudia is great at that. You can tell. She didn't need any help from me. You know, sure, it's for people who have been, quote, judicially involved, but it's really for everyone. It's an American story because you look at 26 million businesses in the country. They didn't get started by going on Shark Tank. That's a kind of a neat show and everything, but that's not how people get started. People get started with a low amount of capital, $500 or less, and they get their first customer and they grow their business organically. So we cover all that stuff. And that's really an American story. I really got into this thing because of Reverend Harris and because of my experience with the judicial system. But really, I just like helping people start businesses because, again, that's the American dream.
Hamilton has a TV program called Free Enterprise, hosted by ABC's Ryan Smith, where they tell success stories of inmates turned entrepreneurs, people like Claudia Shivers.
I would love to take Queen Coffee Bean global. I would love to have a lot of education. It's one of my components. So the mission of Queen Coffee Bean is actually to become the diversity and inclusion solution for the global coffee industry. I'm starting small, but I'm thinking big, Sherry.
Claudia Shivers, owner of Queen Coffee Bean and dreamer of big dreams.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.